Blog Talk Radio.
Live on location as I walk down Madison Avenue, 46th Street, 45th Street. Here we are right in the heart of it as we talk about the Mets here on the Metsian podcast. Thank you all for joining us. We like to add a little bit of New York atmosphere sometimes, so here I am, and that is a buck. Hopefully it's not too loud. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining us on the Metsian podcast every week or as often as we can do this. We have a very special guest who is making her podcast debut, talking about her favorite team. But before we bring her on, I want to go all the way up into Connecticut and say hello to Rich Farago. Rich, you know, we can still have fun anytime on this podcast, regardless of the circumstances.
I hope, because the circumstances are bad, Sam. And how are you, by the way? And thanks for hosting tonight. The circumstances in Metsville are anything but good, and I don't know. Why talk about it now? We're going to peel it all back in a few minutes, so I'll just say good evening. And this morning I was right where you are. I was at the Starbucks on 43rd and 3rd, so I'm very close to where you are. I was.
Well, isn't that funny? I was lucky enough to go to Bobby Vann's for the first time tonight, way after the fact, birthday dinner that my sister from Colorado was providing me tonight. So thanks to her, and I have to give Bobby Vann a grade A with A plus when it comes to that restaurant. Everybody check it out. It's in the Helmsley Building. I love this town one way or another. So let us bring on our featured guest. We interact all the time on Twitter, but had never considered this until recently, and that is Lauren. Lauren, I said you were from Queens, but with the 516 area code, I'm guessing you just commute, but, you know, that's what we're going to hear your Metsian story as well as your tri-state story. So, first of all, thank you for joining us on the Metsian podcast.
Thank you guys for having me and letting me make my podcast debut.
Well, here we are. So, you know, let's save, you know, we kind of have like a shameless plug halfway through. So before we get into the nitty gritty of your Metsian exploration, so in your Mets debut with everything going on, what's the first thing you want to say about it?
Oh my God. We were talking about this a little bit before, but I think like the thing that really I can't wrap my head around right now is how, you know, this Mets team went and beat the Padres and they beat the Dodgers. I mean, they came home to play the Nationals after a 7-3 road trip and they've gone absolutely cold. Like, it looks like a completely different team. And I just don't understand what happened, and it's driving me absolutely insane trying to figure it out.
Well, I appreciate that. You're not a unicorn when it comes to the Mets driving you insane. So, Rick, unpack it for us. I myself have not been able to follow on an inning-to-inning basis like I like to as a fan. So what's been going on, man?
Well, you know, Sam, here's my take. My take is going into the season, you knew there was some fragility involved. And the fragility was the age at the top of the rotation. So this team was supposed to be predicated on a strong starting rotation. And on paper, sure, absolutely. You know, you've got Verlander, you've got Scherzer. You had high hopes for Senga, Quintana. Pretty damn good, but it was a bit fragile because of the age of Scherzer and Verlander. we didn't know what Senga was going to be. You know, he pitched in the WBC, yeah, of course, but his body of work had been in Japan. The ball's smaller. You know, people talk about that. We had high hopes, but we didn't know. He wasn't a known quantity. And Quintana, that's an unfortunate thing, you know, for his health of what happened. So this was a team that was supposed to have excellent starting pitching. Even after Diaz went down, the bullpen was going to be good enough. The offense was I think they scored the fourth most runs in baseball last year. The same group of guys came back. So, you know, and it's just but the number one thing was going to be the rotation, and it's been horrible. It's been, you know, for the New York Mets with the amount of money in that rotation to be, I think, 27th in innings pitched in the starting rotation, it crumbled. And you see how much pitching matters, right? Because they're playing down every game. And, yeah, the offense has been sporadic, but we'll talk about that later. But what's happening here is the starting pitching is not holding up their end of the bargain, where a lot of the money is invested. And it's just been a disaster. You know, they're playing, like I said, playing from behind every game. And that, to me, is what's happening. And that's not some amazing take. You know, we all watch it every night. And that's what's going on.
And, you know, I think I saw a stat on SNY today that said something like they're, like, 3 or 4 and, 13 in the last that amount of games. Not going to do math real quick. So, like, this is falling off real quick. So, Lauren, we have a lot of negativity to talk about over the next hour. So, I will start with this. Positive. What with all these losses that have been piling up lately, what have you seen that is actually positive out of the 2023 Mets?
Oh, I feel like Mets Twitter is going to hear this and, like, want to rip my throat out, but I'm used to that. I feel like, you know, when you look at the lineup, like, Pete's still there and Lindor is still there. Like we said, like, these are guys, this is a lineup that consists of guys who won 101 games last year. Like, I know that September happened and the wild card happened, and I get it, and that's the thing that sticks out in everybody's mind, especially with the way things are going right now. But, like, we know what this lineup is capable of. We know how destructive that they can be. And, I mean, like, I genuinely feel that they're capable of doing that again. Like, I don't see any reason as to why they can't. But, you know, I also feel like that you have two young guys in the minor leagues who are absolutely tearing it up, and we're just, like, leaving them down there. And I, at this point, can't see why we're continuing to do that.
Can I jump in?
Rich, I was about to follow up with you on that. Let's go right into it.
So to support what Lauren just said, and again, I was thinking about this before the podcast, and I'm not sure if this is going to make sense, but let me know. The Mets, do you get the feeling, Lauren and Sam, that the Mets are playing with 24 players right now? And here's what I mean by that. Escobar and Pham, they don't even use these guys, right? These guys are phantom players that are not being used. So why in the living hell would you not bring up Mauricio and Vientos and just jettison these guys? They're, you know, Escobar's in the second year of a two-year contract. Pham's in a one-year contract. And now, yes, I understand we don't want to bring up Mauricio and Vientos and have them sit on the bench. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is Epler and Buck, they sit down and they figure out, if we bring these two guys up, how will we get them a reasonable number of at-bats? It's not really that hard, because Vientos could DH against left-handed pitching, and the Mets have seen a fair amount of that, right? And secondly, you could get Mauricio in there because Canna's not doing anything. So you could put McNeil in left field, and then Mauricio could play second base. And not every day, but you can get them. If you could figure out a plan to give these guys a reasonable number of at-bats so you're not stifling their growth, this way you're using your entire 26-man roster, because they're not. It was driving me crazy, and I was thinking about it today. They're like, Pham and Escobar, they don't even use them. So find a way to make sure these guys get some at-bats, bring them up, and get rid of the deadwood. My God, what do you guys think about that?
So, Lauren, before you, Lauren, before you say something, I will go here with Escobar. Now, Matt, mind you, the last time that I was at a game was the first game of the doubleheader, and Escobar hit a pinch hit home run. Hit a pinch hit home run to get us just a little bit closer. But that was the type of game it was, where we just kept trying to come back and could never get over the finish line. But I still personally think that, you know, they need to use him better, like Rich is saying, but I still think Escobar has value on this team. When you talk about Tana, who I think has this weird, unsuspecting, dry personality that like, he's funnier than you'd expect, but that's not what's winning you ballgames. Whatever he's doing in the clubhouse is not winning you ballgames, and he's only hitting about 215. So Tana, I feel as if has less value on this team than Escobar, who's an excellent defenseman, can hit a pinch hit home run and get you one run away from tying the game in the ninth inning. I still think Escobar has value, and I would want that type of analysis out of the people who are making these decisions. Go ahead, Lauren.
I agree that, first of all, I didn't even, like, think about the fact that, Escobar and Sam are, like, barely even used. But now that Rich mentions it, like, it's true. Like, when was the last time you've seen either one of them, like, come into a game? And even when they do, like, you know, I feel like it's just very unproductive. And, you know, you go back to Vientos and Mauricio, who I feel like every day are, like, hitting home runs or just, you know, stacking up RBIs in the minors, and you're like, bring them up. Like, look what happens when you give Batty playing time and when you give Alvarez more playing time. Like, they're starting to come into their own, and they're very exciting. And, you know, like, that excitement could really spark something in a team. So why not? Like, why are you wasting them in the minor leagues when they could be up here getting their playing time, getting their experience, and maybe creating a spark in this team that we really need right now?
So, Rich, first of all, before I pass it to you to keep having this topic-filled conversation, I want to stay on this. Is it Batty? Because I just want to make sure I haven't been there enough to hear whether maybe Red Batty has said this is how it's pronounced. And Lauren, I'm not passive-aggressively calling you out. It's just that until a certain point, I've heard people say this, Batty instead of Batty, and I think it was happening on the last podcast, too, that I unfortunately couldn't be on, Rich. So how exactly does Brett want it pronounced?
Oh, yeah, good question.
Everything I've heard is Batty. I mean, Gary Cohen says Batty. Everybody says Batty. It doesn't mean it's right. I mean, but that is the going pronunciation of his name that I hear on TV. So that's why I say it, Batty. But that's what I'll go with.
I like the idea, like, Batty's going batty with his bat, you know, type thing. Like, I like the play on words. So anyway. So, yeah, with everything Lauren just said, my take on Escobar, let's keep unpacking this specific when it comes to, like, and I said it before on the text messages between the three of us. I think at this point you have to live and die with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, and there are a couple of other guys. So you have Sam and my – I have really nothing against Escobar, but you're not going to use him. You know, I made that point already. But, and you look at, they don't really use Guillorme much. They use him a little bit more than the other two. I know there are a lot of concerns about Vogelbach, and I think that's a very divisive topic about whether or not Vogelbach is a productive person that, you know, that you want on the team or not. That's something people talk about.
Let me just say, however, that just in terms of the Vogelbach thing, when you look up and down that lineup, he is hitting 270. And you know, there does seem to be some value, and he seems to be getting better and fit properly into his role since coming over somehow, some way. He made a terrible base running mistake the other day. But other than that, that's my take on Vogelbach.
Yeah, he's not the reason that they're struggling. I mean, Vogelbach, I'm like, you know, I'm okay with him. I'm not one of the fans that wants to get rid of the guy right away. Thing about Vogelbach is his OB, people point to his OBP of 405, which is very good. I mean, that's a very good on base percentage. The problem with that, and I use air quotes on problem, because he is a very selective hitter, and as a DH, you know, that's typically a run producing position. It is frustrating to see him get called out on strikes with runners on base. And the other thing about him having a 405 or a 407 actually OBP is that when he gets on base, that's not really a huge positive because he can't run. And if you really think about that, you know, if Eric Young Jr. had a 405 OBP, that's like, oh, my God, this guy's on base, you know, 40 times. He's going to steal base. This is great, right? With Vogelbach, I mean, all joking aside, he's actually a liability on the base side. And so it takes down the value of that OBP a little bit. You'd like to see a little more power out of him. But his numbers, if you look at them,
you wish that Eric Young Jr. wasn't a coach and that he was still a pinch runner constantly for the New York Mets. Like, you and Eric Young Jr. go way back, Rich. And I think
we do.
Weirdly, I think there's some experimentation with this idea of a designated runner going on. That's another thing, you know, to talk about. So, like, you. Weirdly enough, I'm being both, you know, joking and also, hey now, maybe that extends certain people's careers. You know, having a designated runner, you bring him in for Vogelbach every single time.
Well, but you think about it, right? And if it's a tie game and Vogelbach in the eighth inning, and Vogelbach does what he does, he gets on via walk. That's fantastic. You know, you have your potential lead run on base. That's great. But the problem is, it's going to take six hits to score him. You know what I mean? And it's just like, and if you have a Tim LaCastro, and they have to do something with him, by the way, because this guy can't be on a rehab assignment forever. And I think it's 10 days, and he's already done like four or five. So if they bring him back, that's his role. I mean, if Vogelbach gets on base late in the game, his role is to come in and steal the base and get himself in scoring position. I don't know. I think I've said enough about Vogelbach. There are opportunities on this team. You know, my summary statement is there are opportunities on this team to replace some players who are either not being used, not productive, and usually the two go hand in hand, and give these kids a shot. And I know, I've seen Sal Licata go crazy about how many contending teams have four rookies in the lineup and all this kind of thing. Well, you know what? How many contending teams have guys like Mark Canha and Eduardo Escobar, I know you're a fan, but and guys like that who aren't doing anything. I mean, these guys in their mid-30s who are doing nothing. And so, I don't know. I think that's my take. My take is jettison the deadwood, come up with a plan to make sure these guys continue growing on the major league level and do it.
Lauren, do you think there's any of that thought process going in to tomorrow, you know, with all of this time between now, between the last game we had and the next game, for this front office to do something?
I don't understand how there couldn't be. And, like, you know, as I was listening to you guys talk, like, I just, one organization, and we hate them, and I hate myself for giving them any sort of credit whatsoever, but the Braves, like, they bring up their guys. They're not afraid to bring them up and throw them in a game and throw them in the next day.
And sign them immediately.
Just like, and, you know, and we're envious because they're in our division and they're one of our biggest rivals, and it's so aggravating. But when you're in this position that we're in right now and you're looking at the Santos Mauricio, you're like, what? Like, just bring them up. Like, what do we have to lose by bringing them up? Nothing. Why take a page out of the Braves playbook here because it's working for them, and just do it.
So, Lauren, when you're looking at the standings and seeing that everybody else but the Braves are kind of grouped together in this, you know, different types of mediocre. And in fact, if I remember correctly, the Marlins might be the only 500 team, and they're not even a winning team. They're just 500 right now,
right
after today. So when you're looking at that, with the fact that it's early, and it's still early, look at what happened last season with the Braves alone, speaking of them.
Right.
When you look at the you know, the way the standings roll out, the Nationals are better than anybody expected, really, and right behind the Mets. Can you take solace in the idea that any of us could turn it around, but the Braves all the way at the top?
I mean, look, I do think, you know me, if you follow me on Twitter long enough to know that I'm like, well, it's May, like, it's still early. I believe I do believe that they can turn it around. I genuinely do. I mean, you know, I think we're a better team than the Marlins. I think we're a better team than the Nationals. I even am going to say that I think that we're a better team than the Phillies. Like, look at what the Phillies did last year. Like, they came out of absolutely nowhere, winning 88 games, getting into that wild card, and then taking it and running with it all the way to the World Series. Like, if they could do that, then why can't this Mets team do the same thing, but even, like, surpass 88 wins? Because this team is capable of more than 88
wins. Hey, I'm not sure. I can't hear Lauren. Lauren, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear Lauren.
Oh,
I hear Lauren.
We got it. I lost you for a second.
Okay.
I apologize. Keep going.
Oh, okay. I was giving you a whole big powerful speech right now. No,
we're living in 2013, technologically speaking, with these podcasts, but that's another conversation for another day.
It's all good. I'm just saying, you know, like, if you just look at what happened last year with the Braves, with the Phillies, I genuinely believe, and people are going to call me crazy for this, and that's fine, but I genuinely believe that the Mets are a better team than the Nationals and the Marlins and the Phillies, and they can do exactly what either the Braves or the Phillies did last year and just completely turn it around. I mean, the Braves are always going to – they're going to be at the top for a while now. They're going to be our biggest competition, I feel. Even with Bryce Harper returning to the Phillies, like, I still see the Braves as our biggest competition. But I do not see any reason why the Mets can't, you know, do what they did and turn this whole thing around and be playoff bound, you know, in September and October.
So, Rich, same question, just about the standings, but also categorize it with Buck involved as well.
Well, all right, about the standings, I think at this point, obviously we all know, like Lauren said, it's very early and all that stuff, but I think the framing that I like to think about is right now the Mets are, last time I checked, they were 2 games out of a wild card. So if the season ended today, using that little cliche, they would be out of the playoff picture by 2 games. So being 2 games out of a wild card spot is nothing, especially when it's only May. And like Lauren was saying, all you have to do is get into the postseason. We saw it with the Padres. The Padres were not supposed to come into Citi Field and knock the Mets out. The Phillies were not supposed to go to St. Louis and knock the Cardinals out, nor were they supposed to knock the Braves out. So as long as you get invited to the dance, that's what matters. Winning division, yes, I do think that's important. However, we've seen it's not mission critical. So right now, the way I'm framing it in my head, is there a game or two or three or whatever the number is, it's between 1 and 3, it's somewhere in there, of the last wild card, which is negligible. That's a rounding error. So they have plenty of time to make that up. You know, all they have to do is start playing some better baseball and get invited to the party in October. That's that. Now, you asked about Buck. You know, I'm a big Buck fan. I do believe that an experienced manager is very important. I think that in this day and age, it's not about X's and O's anymore. Managers don't make those decisions. Those decisions are driven by the analytics. They're passed down. What a manager needs to do is be a leader of the personalities. He needs to keep the clubhouse together. That, to me, is what a manager is doing today, as opposed to, you know, when Davey Johnson ran the show. So, and I think Buck, with his experience, is very good at that. I think he's very good at keeping things positive, keeping the players engaged, trying to use everybody. But my criticism of Buck that I'm seeing, and I'd be fascinated to hear your take, I know that every manager gets criticized for the use of the bullpen, but take Sunday, for example. Okay. Mets are off on Monday. Sunday, you have Lucchesi, and we knew it was going to be a short outing. Okay, fine. You know, he pitched valiantly, not well, but valiantly. They kept them in the game, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. And then they go to Yakubonis. And I don't know about you two, but to me it was like I wanted to knock on his forehead and say, Buck, Jimmy's got nothing out there. The game is slipping away very quickly. You have the day off tomorrow. And people say this on Twitter, and you know it. Are you punting this game for some reason where you're trying to play the long game and forget about today, which I understand sometimes that's what you have to do. But really, Buck, just tell me, what are you doing? You had the lead. You have a guy on the mound who's getting the living crap kicked out of him. The game is slowly, like sand through the hourglass, the game is slowly slipping away, and you're watching it happen. And I know you can't overuse the bullpen. I understand that these guys are human. They only have so many pitches. But you're off the next day. You have the lead. This isn't a blowout, or wasn't a blowout until it became one. That, and that's happened a few times this year, you know, where you sit there and you watch it and you read Twitter and everybody's like, Buck's punting the game, Buck's punting the game. And I get it. You know, I get that you can't go to these guys every day. He says it all the time. But when they have a scheduling advantage, like, you know, a day off or something, I'm really starting to wonder sometimes what he's thinking about. I'm fascinated to hear what you both might think.
Lauren, before I pass it to you, I will just say I was at the bar, Rudy's Bar and Grill. Stop by for a shot and a beer and a hot dog, everybody. Chambers Blood. I was there that day, and obviously the sound was off. I had the game on, and I very much was like, wait, was there an injury? But I could also tell the way that SNY was editing the entire thing, that they were questioning Buck's decision. Whether that had anything to do with Lucchesi or not, you could also see Lucchesi in the dugout, kind of a little ponderous as well. So my question is not even like, why is he keeping that bullpen guy in as long as he did? I didn't understand with a lead, a 4-3 lead, and the need to, if you're talking about resting people, you know, what Rich just said about the bullpen playing the long game, then why are you not playing the long game by giving a starter who has settled in more time on the mound? He took him out with four innings behind him. I didn't understand that element if the guy is not injured.
I think I don't know if I want to say that Buck overthinks sometimes, but I always get the feeling that he's like, that, yeah, maybe that he's essentially like overthinking. And, you know, but I felt like in the past with other managers, that's always been the one thing that I felt like they just like can't get right, like how to use the bullpen correctly. And when to use the right pitchers. And, like, I feel like it's the most frustrating part of being a fan and watching either at the ballpark or at home. And you're like, okay, this would be a great opportunity for so-and-so to come in. And then, you know, the starting pitcher comes back out for another. And you're like, why? It's a terrible idea. And then it blows up in your face. And you're like, see, I just feel like sometimes with Buck that he's just like, I feel like he's in his head too much. He's very smart, and I don't want this to seem like I know more than him, because I really don't. But like, I feel like he just gets too in his own head about it sometimes. And I would love to see him utilize like a day off with, you know, extending a starter a little bit, or putting Ottavino or Robertson in, like you know, like when they haven't pitched in like 5 days, like there's no need to like keep them in the bullpen not doing anything either. So that's always been like a frustration for me with any manager ever, is like the usage of the bullpen.
You are listening to the Mets Scene Podcast. We are a half hour in, and with that, because I just can't talk about the case anymore. All of a sudden, I'm having a flashback to how triggering that was. I'm like, what? Lauren, I would like you to tell our audience your Metsian history, as we like to call it, both your baseball history and a tri-state history, too, in effect, as well.
Well, as you noticed with my 516 number, I am not from Queens. I grew up on Long Island, in Long Beach, actually. I work in Queens. I'm a teacher in Queens. I'm not going to say where because I don't need people for trying to find me, but so popular and everything. But ever since I was a kid, like, you know, my dad is a huge Mets fan. That's where my love of sports came from. That's where my love of the Mets came from. That's where any knowledge I have of any sport really comes from, is my dad. And, you know, I remember going to Shea Stadium as a kid. One game in particular, it was Father's Day. It was against the Marlins, and it was probably the hottest day of my entire life. And I remember, like, being at one of the stands and just, like, eating ice and, like, just the most uncomfortable game I've ever been to. But I did get Benny Avvayani's autograph on a piece of paper that day and carried it around with me for some time until I lost it somewhere. So, you know, like, I had this, like, deep love and passion for the Mets, and I played softball growing up. You know, I did the Little League thing. And when it was time to, you know, get out of the T-ball situation and you get into your position, you know, and I started out in the outfield, you know, picking grass. So they moved me in the infield, and then I played with the dirt. So then they made me a catcher. And growing up, you know, as a 90s kid, who better to emulate in anything was Mike Piazza. But he would be very disappointed if he ever saw me hit or catch. He would be very disappointed in me about that. I did not do Mike Piazza any justice. I mean, defensively, we might have been about the same, but offensively, I don't think so. I think he would have been like, you know what, it's okay if you don't try and be me. Like, just don't.
I feel like he would have actually been very encouraging right now if he were on here, and he's been like, you were probably better than you think you are, but he'd probably have a beast to pick, you know, with you about the defensive part on his side, on, you know, how he was.
I'm sure he would. And Mike Piazza, if you ever happen to listen to this, I love and adore you still to this day. But, like, it's just the truth of the matter, you know. I'm not saying this to, like, for people to be like, oh, no, you probably were better than you thought. I really wasn't. Like, my dad was my coach for most of my Little League time, and he kept me on the bench. So that doesn't speak volumes about how not good I was. I don't know what does. I don't mean to
unpack this as if I'm your psychotherapist, but maybe your dad being, you know, like the parent, whatever type of parent he may have been, was actually doing you detriment and not giving you enough opportunities to learn how to hit better. Whoa.
My dad's going to listen to this.
Hey, by the way, by the way, Mr. Lauren, I don't know your last name, so Mr. Lauren, I have to extend this invitation to the podcast. You are welcome to join anytime.
My dad would talk your both of you your ears off for like an hour, but I think he'd be a lot of fun. Honestly, he has so much knowledge, and sometimes I'm just like, I listen to him and I'm just like, how? It's like listening to Gary Cohen sometimes. Like, and it's funny because I'll watch a game with my dad, and we'll have SNY on, and he'll say something, and then like 5 seconds later, Gary says something, and I'm like, are you guys like the same person? It's really funny, you know, to listen to him. But that's why I am who I am. You know, that's why I'm the Mets fan that I am, is because, you know, of my dad and, you know, going to games with him and him telling me what would probably be useless information to everyone else, but is always like interesting information to me because it's what, you know, makes me grow as a fan. And I don't know. I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest with you. I mean, I would have it another way where the Mets were a winning team, but I wouldn't have it any other way otherwise.
Well, Lauren, we really appreciate you sharing your story and also coming on the podcast tonight. And the way that I will segue this over to Rich, I may be going to get an Anthony Rizzo Mandalorian bobblehead tomorrow, Rich, but this podcast and what we have, just the character and there's just something different, having been on both sides of things between the Yankees and the Mets, of why I am so thrilled that I converted, even if I'm getting a Anthony Rizzo Mandalorian bobblehead, not just for myself, that was a decision tomorrow, but also because of a friend who used to be, who not used to be a Cubs fan, who are Cubs fans and love Anthony Rizzo, and also love Star Wars. But, Rich, this is why I love, no matter where we are, I love the Mets fan base.
Well, the thing about Mets fans is that, you know, we're loyal through thick and thin, and I think that's the best part. Like, whenever I meet people, I say I'm a Mets fan, that's a sign of character, right? Because if you stick with them and you go through all the ups and downs, and let's face it, I've been a Mets fan, I think, longer than both of you, and there are more downs than ups, to be completely frank, we know that. But, you know, they're a team that you stick with, they're, I don't know, they become part of you. Like, Mets fans are, I think, loyal to a fault. I don't have to say to a fault. They're extremely loyal. And you see the same level of passion in this fan base every year. So, yeah, I mean, those are all really good things. I think it's a sign of character that we stick with them and we invest in them. Well, look what we're doing right now. I mean, we're on a Thursday night. We're talking about the Mets on a podcast, and they're a part of who we are. I think the other thing about Mets fans that we get, you know, picked on for a lot is we do kind of have the woe is me, not the three of us, but in general, the fan base can have the woe is me, the, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop and taking something positive and turning it into a negative kind of a thing. But I think that's a learned behavior, you know, because we've been disappointed a lot. We're being disappointed this year. So, but no, it's fun. I'm glad that you're with us, Sam. I'm glad that Lauren, you're with us, and you know, we'll stick it out through the bad times, and hopefully the good times are right around the corner. You know, I'm just reading something here that if the Mets go into Washington and take 3 out of 4, they're a 500 team when they come back home. Granted, they have to play the Rays, but they'll be a 500 team, and they can kind of go from there. So, yeah, hopefully the better days are coming.
I think the Mets.
So I don't want to go too much. And that's a good cue, and I will get to Ted Lasso in a moment, Lauren. I appreciate you reminding me. Look, we're not about to fire Buck immediately just to hire Ted Lasso, who's a fictional character. However, I do want to ask you both this, and I will give a little bit of a speech about it. I think the Yankees and their fans, so both the actual organization as well as the fan base, are going through a little bit of an existential crisis. The Yankees have an existential crisis right now. And why I say that is because they grew up with entering Yankees way. which is basically you dominate for 26 of 100 seasons, on top of dominating much more than that. But, you know, they made 40 of 100. Like, I think it was maybe not 40. I think it's at that point it was 38 or 39 because of 2003. But they dominated a crazy, you know, 40% of an entire century, more or less. And on top of that, dominated when they didn't make a World Series. So this is what the fan base and the franchise themselves grew up with. And they seem to still be operating as if that's going to be a given. They're increased their analytics, but it hasn't necessarily worked the same way it has with other teams. And at certain points, it seems to have gotten in the way of them not only learning but also winning. The fan base themselves, you're never going to have the same dominance in the world that we live in, parity-wise. And so if you put yourself into their shoes, I've recently realized that the ones barking about 27 rings not only aren't even big Yankee fans themselves, even though they claim to be, they're not even fans of the sport all that much. So I actually respect certain Yankee fans, one of them being John Boy, because he seems to not only have some just really good analytical videos about baseball itself, but he seems to, I am a Yankee fan, and that's, you know, I just haven't seen him be like that chest-thumping Yankee fan that others are, and I appreciate that about it. But I think overall, as just a general, the same way we're talking about this this shared experience of woe is me, like you talked about, Rich, and I'll go to Lauren first with this, I think the Yankee fan is going through an existential crisis, and it's going to be interesting, both on the team's perspective as well as the fan's perspective, as to how they react to it. Go ahead, Lauren.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I've seen it, you know, on Twitter, and I have to say that, you know, I never really got along with a lot of Yankee fans because the first thing they always say is, you know, 27 World Champ, like, yeah, I know. Can I, like, tell me something that I don't know? And I always hated that.
How many of those were you alive for?
Right. Yeah, like, that's always the thing, is that, like, there are usually people, like, around my age, maybe a little bit older, but usually younger, who are, like, screaming that at me, and I'm like, did you
see
one?
Who literally only lived through 2009.
Right, exactly. And I'm just like, okay, like, what? That's your only thing that you have to, like, scream in my face. And at this point, like, you know, I'm 32, and that's something that I've heard my, you know, entire life about how many rings that the Yankees have and blah, blah, blah. So it's just, it's not something that, like, insults me anymore, because I'm just like, okay, like, congratulations. Like, do you want a cookie? Like, I don't know what you want for, you know, telling me this, but I have on Twitter have had some interactions with some decent Yankee fans recently, and, you know, ones who are able to, like, have that, like, a logical conversation with you and be like, yeah, like, no, the Mets are a good team, and I respect it, and you're like, well, like, you guys exist, like, are you okay, like, is this real, like, am I dreaming that a Yankee fan is able to give, like, the Mets any sort of credit? But watching Yankee fans on Twitter right now is probably one of the most fascinating things, because their tweets are so similar to, like, Mets Twitter tweets. Like, it's just become, like, one big mosh of, like, what fan base am I reading right now? Because it's the same, like, the world is crashing down, everything's gone wrong, I, like, want to run in front of a car kind of tweets that I'm seeing, and I'm like, who's who? Like, what? Like, what is happening? So, yeah, I definitely agree. Yankee fans are going through it right now, and I kind of think it sucks, because last year when both the Mets and the Yankees were doing really well, it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And But yeah, no, they're becoming very similar to Mets Twitter.
So, Rich, before I send it your way about this, I'll also add this context to the Yankees' existential crisis. They have always been what the Houston Astros are to them now, to every other team. I can't remember at any point, and maybe you can bring some insight on this somehow, some way, in terms of ever during any period, whether it's the 60s to the late 70s or the 80s, when ironically the Yankees are the most winning team in baseball, and they, you know, Yankee fans like to pretend like that was the dark period. They've never had a team for them like the Houston Astros are now, and I think that's also a part of the existential crisis Yankee fans are having.
I think that's true. I can't think of a team like the I can't think of a version of the Braves to the Yankees. You know what I mean? The Yankees always found a way to beat anyone. Like they were to the Kansas City Royals in the 70s, what the Astros are to them now, because the Royals would have these really good seasons. The Yankees and the Royals that seemingly met in the ALCS every year, and the Yankees always won until 1981. The Yankees always won. They were Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown, because those Royals teams were very, very good, but they just could not beat the Yankees. Like the Mets teams of the 90s could not beat the Braves. And as you were asking the question, I can't think of any team that's given them that kind of trouble. You know, yes, of course, the Red Sox 1 year in 2004 when they were down 3-0, but it's not a year-over-year kind of a thing. But getting back to the existential crisis, you know, let me ask you guys this question. Is it that the Yankees are becoming like Mets Twitter, or is Mets Twitter and Mets fans becoming like the Yankees a little bit? Let me tell you why I'm saying that. Typically, the kind of angst we're feeling right now, or whatever we're feeling as Mets fans, you know, that palpable thing, it comes from unfulfilled expectations. Because, Sam, when we were doing this podcast in 2013, we were talking about, okay, look, you know, we just want the Mets to be respectable on the field. We know they're rebuilding, blah, 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 blah. There wasn't this anger. There wasn't this, you know, this fire Epler because they spent $370 million and team's not as below 500. Because right now the Mets have expectations. And those high expectations that come with a high payroll are not being fulfilled. So now you're seeing more venom on Mets Twitter. You're seeing more anger. And the two fan bases are kind of merging because that's what Yankee fans are going through. They're supposed to be the Yankees. Their expectations are not being fulfilled. We're the New York Yankees. Why are we in last place in the American League East? I mean, Michael Kay was whining about that at the beginning of tonight's game against the Rays. He was talking about, you know, if the Yankees are in any other division, they'd be in first place. He was, oh, my God, give them a tissue already. You know what I mean? But it's like it's that angst and anger that comes from we're supposed to be here, we're here, we're mad about that, and we're gonna turn on each other. Both fan bases are kind of doing the same thing, and I think it's coming from the fact that now as Mets fans, the Yankees believe they should win because they wear the pinstripes. The Mets fans now feel like we should be winning because we have a $370 million payroll and the richest owner in sports. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
No, it totally does. I think certain Mets fans can have a bit of hubris, which is ironic because that's what we kind of gave the Wilpon crap about for so many years, was their hubris. So I always feel, and I'll tell this story. I was at a game in Colorado where the Mets were playing in 2012. I was in the bleachers. Great. If you haven't been to Coors Field, everybody should go. It other than the way it plays, it's my favorite ballpark. It would be a pitcher's park anywhere else if it weren't in Colorado. But it's a gorgeous ballpark, and you just wish that one, I wish the uniforms were better, and two, I wish that they figured out a better way of having success in a place like Denver, because Denver's one of my loves. But I was out there, and it was the top, I think, of the 10th inning, and we had just gone ahead 6-5. and all of a sudden some Met fan stands up and starts applauding loudly, but then kind of also like mocking the Rocky fans around him. And I was like standing and applauding, but like I looked at him, and the second I saw him do that, I went, whoa, like he was too far away for me to like actually interact with him. But like, you know, whoever was with me was just like, could see that I was just like, hey, let's take it easy. We haven't won the game yet. Let's take it easy. Of course, Frank Francisco gives up the run in the bottom of the 10th inning, and then we win it in 11th. But we're only lucky that we won it in 11th. Sometimes, Lauren, I'll send it to you with this. Sometimes I do think to what Rich is talking about, the fan base is kind of merging. It may have been happening way before this particular intersection, this particular junction.
So it's funny that you said that, because that's exactly what I was thinking when Rich was talking about it, is that, like, I've been on Twitter for a while, and one thing that Mets Twitter is very consistent at is arguing with each other and fighting with each other and being so incredibly, like, cruel to one another. And it's something that, for me, like, when I first started out on Twitter, I was definitely the person who would, like, pick fights, and I was one of probably the more miserable people on Twitter, which, like, if you look at my tweets now, it's definitely different. It's always been consistent on my Twitter. And I think just over time, it's just grown a lot more, that anger and that frustration. And I'm not saying that fans don't have a right to be angry and frustrated. I just like wish sometimes that, like, you know, you can't hear people's tone and you like, or how they intend to say things. And then, you know, you're answering, replying to the person, and you're assuming things. And then it's this back and forth. I wish people would just take the time sometimes. And I know I'm asking for a lot here, but I wish people would just take the time sometimes to just like read it, think about it, you know, and be like,
yep,
this makes sense. Like, you know, like, and like, or, and if you don't, and you're not sure, like, ask, like, why, instead of just jumping down, like, down someone's throat and jumping to conclusions about what you think someone was saying, or if you think someone was subtweeting you or whatever ridiculous thing that we're going to fight about, like, why don't you just ask the person? Like, and if you don't want to do it publicly, send them a DM and just be like, hey, like, what did you mean by this? Like, I feel like it would just be so much better if people just stop and just were like, you know what, like, let me just read this again. Like, maybe there's something I'm not understanding, like, you know, and if you aren't, just ask. Like, just ask the person. There's no need to jump down someone's throat and just automatically, you know, go after them in such a cruel way when we're all talking about a baseball team that we love so much. And we all want that. Like, we want them to win. We all want that. That's the main goal, is we want a winning team. We want a championship. We want many championships. But, like, we're fighting with each other about, like, our opinions and our feelings. And it's just something that absolutely drives me crazy. And I think I'm, you know, I've been guilty of this, too, in the past. I may be guilty of this now, and I don't realize it. I try to be as self-aware as possible. But, like, it's something that just genuinely frustrates me, and, you know, my positive attitude gets me absolutely nowhere on Twitter. Everyone just told me, like,
you're not alone.
Go away.
You're not alone. And unfortunately, a lot of times the way it is written, tone is obvious. And so, first of all, I think this has been a rather profound episode of the Metsian podcast. So, it's considering that we're gaining close to the tail end of it, I just have to say thank you for not to say that we don't always have these great episodes, but there is something very, very fitting, and just the way that we've talked about both the team, the dynamic of both teams in the city, and the fan bases themselves within the modern social media context has been really beautiful to me. So thank you, Lauren. I appreciate you being a part of this. And I will, since we are going to segue off of it, I will go first to Rich just about, you know, we're coming 5 minutes till the hour. So, Rich, where do you want to go with this podcast?
Well, you know, I think we kind of covered what I wanted to cover early, which was what would we do, you know, to try to turn the ship around. And I think we agreed that calling up the young guys and not looking at them as saviors, but finding a way to work them into the lineup. I think we all agree that that might provide some life to this team. The team looks lifeless. And with youth, they're the oldest team in baseball at the beginning of the season. Maybe it's time to inject some more youth. Beatty and Alvarez have worked out fine. Alvarez has – it's been fascinating to watch him develop right before our eyes. Think about what looked like in Atlanta last year when they called him up. I mean, he looked like Dave Kingman. He looked worse than Dave Kingman. I know that he predates you too, but Dave Kingman was a strikeouter, home run hitter, frustrating to watch. It was Alvarez. He was swinging from his heels. And think about what this guy does now. He goes the other way. He puts good at-bats on. He gives you good framing. He's a good defensive catcher. So we're seeing that. Beatty, we're seeing it too. I have no problem going back to the well two more times and trying to do something because it's just not working. What's here is not working. And it's not a question of just being a typical fan overreacting. There's something fundamentally wrong here. And I've never been a big fan of, you know, fire the manager. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is let's identify dead wood. Let's get some youth in here, maybe some exuberance, and try to light a fire because it's still early, but a month from now we might not be saying that. You know, we're about to turn the quarter pole of the season. They have 40 games in, I believe, right? And so you're at the quarter pole of the season. I don't want to get to the All-Star break and have this continuing. So the season is salvageable. You're not going to go out and make a bunch of trades right now, but I think you can identify some ways and within your own system of doing some things. So that's where I wanted to go.
Lauren, take it away.
Oh.
You know, I'm going to go right back to bringing up Vientos and Mauricio. Like Rich said, you know, like we talked about in the very beginning of this podcast, what we have is not working. It's just not. And as much as, you know, I appreciate, you know, Escobar and Kenna and what they did for this team last year, and even Guillorme, even though I got on his case a few nights ago, like, something has to give. And I know people will be like, oh, but Mauricio and Vientos don't, you know, help the starting pitching problem. And that is correct. They don't help the starting pitching problem. But we need to start somewhere and fast, because this season can get away from us just as fast. And I don't know what more has to happen for the front office to be like, you know, Vientos and Mauricio, or one at a time, however they want to do it. It doesn't matter. It just needs to happen. Something needs to happen. It could be the spark that we need. And the longer they stay down there and the longer that we struggle up here, like, we'll never know. So let's just do it. Bring them up. Let's see what they can do. Get rid of the players who, you know, really don't have use or place on this team anymore. And let's get it going.
So Rich, it sounded like you were going to say something else. And I'll ask you to repeat that, but, he's right that it doesn't help the starting rotation, and obviously I need to do a little in-depth diving into where the current farm system is when it comes to starting and pitching options. But I think there is something to say about youthful exuberance and a shot in the arm, even for the starting pitchers who have been struggling. There is something to be said about the personnel around you. And I think when you have an old starting rotation, maybe they're and Verlander's looked good for two starts in a row, but Scherzer's been struggling obviously as to what pitcher he currently is now, and I don't even want to go into the whole sticky alcohol situation, because I'm it just reminds me that Rob Manfred's running the mafia, but where were you going to go? But also, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to get both of your takes as younger fans on the pitch clock and some of the rule changes. And I think it's the fun thing that we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but I could say this, maybe Lauren will go to you on this. Sam, you can comment on it. I love the pitch clock. I love the faster pace of play. I think it's great. I love the, I wish we didn't have to be in a place where we had to restrict shifting because guys know how to go the other way, but they prove they can't do that or they're not being trained to do that. So I like the shift restrictions. And as much as we all have a disdain, I'll speak for myself, I think a lot of fans do, have disdain for Rob Manfred, you know, with his fake golf swing when they're trying to negotiate the collective bargaining agreement, and he doesn't really know how to read the room. He seems to not get it, like he seems to be kind of socially unaware. But the rule changes, as much as people moaned about them, I think the game, other than the Mets, the game on the field is more entertaining. But I'd be fascinated to hear both of you because I lived through faster games. Then I went into the, you know, the slower games. Now we're back to the faster games, and I really like them a lot more. But I'd be curious as to your take on that.
So I always remember just being at the ballpark for like hours on end. And for me personally, I love that. Like, I the more time that I can spend at the ballpark, the better. Like, that's me forever. I just love being there. It ignites like this childlike, you know, feeling in me, and I just love spending time there. So the fact that we have the pitch clock and we have these faster paced games, and I feel like I'm kind of like shuffled in and shuffled out really quickly, is a little disappointing. Maybe it's just something that I personally have to get used to because I'm not used to it. Or maybe it's something that I'll never get used to. I don't know. It's only been, you know, what, 40 games so far. So I'm still personally adjusting to it. All of a sudden, like, you know, you have a 7 o'clock start and the game's over by like 9:30 and you're like, what am I supposed to do right now? I don't know what to do with myself. And I'm like, what does one do? Because I'm used to the games ending at like 10:30. So I'm like, I have time? Like, what is that? So definitely it's something that I think I'm adjusting to. And maybe one day I'll love it. But right now I'm kind of like in between a rock and a hard place with it.
So, Rich, I'll give it the context of when I fell in love with the game in the first place. A big reason why I fell in love with the game was all of a sudden this ADHD kid that was heavily medicated could focus on something even without the medicine for 3 hours out of his day and only focus and have complete and exclusive focus on three-hour baseball games. My dad used to say, and going back to Michael Kay would, and he probably still has this thing, it's a manageable or immanageable. And manageable was under 3 hours, immanageable was over 3 hours. And my dad would say exactly what Lauren just said. I like the fact that I have 3 hours to spend with baseball. However, I also came into the game when Nomar was first doing his entire routine. And even Nomar, Nomar Garcia-Parra, who I think was kind of the beginning of this entire thing and routine that kind of just got exploited for batters, but he was very concise and to the point with his routine between every single pitch. It was patterned and it was timed. So one way or another, I came into the game when there was more of an understanding that you had to, like, the reason why the pitch clock exists now is because it got out of control. And they felt as if, and I agree with them, and as much as I'm criticizing Rob Manfred earlier, I still think that there, you have to give this credit where credit is due, that nobody was enforcing a rule that was put that was, you know, directed to the umpires to take care of like 15 years ago or something like that, 20 years ago or something like that. So I think it was a necessity, and I love it because I'm still about, I'm also going through my own existential crisis in that I have been trying to find more structure, more cohesion, and more focus in my life. And so when you see something like that that does deliver it to the game I love, I'm all in favor of the more structure. Now, mind you, certain things do take away from the strategy, like only being two throwovers. However, you could also argue with throwing over to first base that it had gotten out of control how many nonchalant throwovers had started to happen where you're not even trying to pick the guy off. Now, you have to try to pick the guy off because you only have two of them. So there is something to be said for even though it takes certain aspects away from the game, it is also not 1920 anymore. And you have to adapt as, you know, as much as possible. And I you know, total quick tangent, this is what I said about the whole Javi Baez Bugate thing, in that, like, you know, this is New York. If you can't handle it, you know, go somewhere else. I think we need to adapt to the fact that, like, this is old fodder. This is stuff that we've been saying within our superiority complex as New Yorkers for years now. It's 2023. Get over ourselves. But that's where I'm at, Rich.
No, I think that's fair, and I think those are very fair points. And the part about adapting and adjusting and all, I think that's exactly what it is. I think if you think about when I was a kid, baseball was more popular than football, right? And obviously football has surpassed it. Football's just done an amazing job at everything. And a lot of the rules have changed. You know, they protect the quarterbacks more. The rule, you know, all these rules, like the pass interference calls, they added more offense to the game. People started following the game more. And so we just have to adjust and adapt, you know, that this is the way it is now, and this is what had to happen. And the fans have to adjust. But I find it very interesting because my daughter is in her 20s, and she's like you, Lauren. She's like, I feel like it's rushed, and I want to sit down and enjoy a long game. And I'm like,
yeah,
it does seem to run along those lines. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting one. And Sam,
I'll
you mentioned
also
earlier.
Wait for this. Yeah, go ahead, Rich. Go ahead. Finish that thought.
No, no, please. What
no,
I was going to say
was,
is you asked. You asked about the potential rule changes that are being piloted this year, and I wrote about that for Mesmerized. And real quickly, I don't know what you both would think about a designated runner. They're piloting that in the Atlantic League. And what that is a guy who can come in and multiple as many times as they want to use them, and it could just run for anybody. So potentially could run for somebody, come right back, go run for the guy who just hit the double, be on second base. So a designated runner with unlimited reentry is being piloted. And they're also piloting one disengagement from the rubber as opposed to two. So now whether or not these rules make it to Major League Baseball, we don't know. But I don't know. I think I might have to draw the line at the runner who just can keep coming back and forth in and out of the game. That's a little too much.
I don't know how I feel about that.
It's a oof.
I think at some point you're getting too cute. Yeah, at some point you're getting too cute.
You're taking it away from the game too much and like by doing that, in my opinion.
I will also, what you were saying about rule changes and stuff, I will, you know, and the idea of, like having the time that, you know, some people are so used to how long the game has been taking lately that they are lamenting the faster pace of play. I will also equate just rule changes, which, like, this isn't exactly a rule change. It's just the way it goes. Basketball. Sometimes the most boring part of the entire game is literally the last 2 minutes of clock that ends up taking a half hour because everybody's fouling the entire time instead of playing the game. Like, that is just like, all right, let's just get this over with. And sometimes the way the bullpen changes, the way the batters are going out, like, there were all of this dead time that wasn't focused on the game that was still a part of the game. And so I can get how 20-somethings are used to what they're used to, but I still, again, go back to just like, all right, let's get this over with. Not saying that, like, my attention span is shorter. I just recognize that something needed to be tighter. And that's another thing, like, since we were talking about other sports as well, a correlation I would make about you know, how you need a quicker pace of play. So, and with that, I believe I will segue to the end of the episode. You have been listening to the Met Scene Podcast, and we're so thankful that you do. And I'm going to go to Lauren for her shameless plug. But first, I will say thank you for joining us. But we like to do this at the end of the episode. We do shameless plug and final word. So I will go to you first, Lauren, for your shameless plug and final word.
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, I mean, thank you guys for having me on your podcast, trusting me to come on and do a good job. So I hope that, you know, that I've done that. But I can't end my time on this podcast without, you know, plugging in one of my favorite quotes from Ted Lasso, only because I think that, like, it's very fitting for the best right now.
Didn't I?
Yeah.
Okay, Lauren, before we go, I did mean to ask you about this. Ted Lasso, number one, I haven't seen this week's episode, so you'll have to
it's
hold on.
It's not from that.
Good. And number two, in your Mets fandom, do you see or can take, and this can be advice giving to other Mets fans or whatnot, what within the Ted Lasso world do you also equate or contrast to your Mets fandom?
Well, I mean, like, you know, AFC Richmond, you know, the fictional soccer team in Ted Lasso, it reminds me a lot of the Mets, but I think the fan base in particular also reminds me a lot about, like, Mets fans, because the loyalty and, you know, how they all just, like, are so passionate about their team and show up for them no matter how many times they disappoint them is just completely, like, I just watch it sometimes and I'm like, no, I totally understand, like, what that feels like, even in a fictional show, because, like, as a sports fan, you know, you live and die by your sports teams, and that's always something with Ted Lasso that's resonated with me as a sports fan. I was like, I totally understand it, but I think what this show has also made me realize is, like, the other part that we don't really remember, and that human component in the players. Like, they're still human. Like, they still have this, you know, they feel the frustration and they feel the disappointment and they feel all the things that we feel, maybe in a different way. Every time, you know, I go on Twitter and you watch people, like, tweet at a player or someone, and they're, like, cursing them up and down, and I'm like, it's still another human being. Like, you're still talking to a person. Like, they didn't wake up that morning and they didn't go, oh, I'm going to try really hard to, like, go 0-for-4 today. Like, you know, you know, and strike out a bunch of times. Like, that's not what they wake up doing. And I think for me, like, one of the things that this show has, like, really opened my eyes to is that human component, like, what goes on in a locker room, you know, behind the scenes when no one else is watching. But I also love, you know, the character of Ted and his positivity. And I think that has rubbed off on me a lot. I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you know that, you know, before the Mets game, I always tweet out, a GIF. I think that's how we pronounce it, GIF, right? of, you know, Ted pointing to the belief side, which I do have in my own classroom, and I point to it to my students too. And when the Mets win, I have another one, and I just love his optimism and his perspective of looking at it is like, you know, there's always tomorrow. Like, you go back out there and you try again, and I don't know, for me, like, you know, as someone who has You Gotta Believe tattooed on my wrist, and you know, it's something that I genuinely try to always remember, and as a sports fan, as a person, as a teacher, and I don't know, like, it's just why I love the show so much and why I try to, like, put it into my tweets as much as possible.
Lauren, I believe in ghosts, but more importantly, I think they should believe in themselves.
I think they should
believe
in themselves.
That's one of my favorite lines. Well, my favorite. Luckily, everybody, we're not spoiling too much for you. It's in the first episode that line happened.
My favorite one these
days,
and I think it's true, it's the be a goldfish. Like, because I have such
right,
short memories. So I'm like, be a goldfish. Yeah, that's my favorite one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could spout off. Like, who would you rather be, a lion or whatever? I forget what the other animal was. And, you know, Jamie goes, you know, that's ridiculous. Why would I want to be anything but myself? I don't think you know how psychologically healthy that is.
Yes.
Anyway, like, it'll become, we're just going to start. Rich, do you watch Ted Lasso?
You know, I intend to, but I have not yet watched it.
Rich, you have to watch Ted Lasso.
I know. Everybody says that. And my own brother's like, when are you going to sit down and watch it? And I have to watch it.
It's life-changing.
Well, it's about to finish its third season. So you'll have a nice amount of material for in between Mets games as well as seasons of Ted Lasso. So there you go. Lauren, I appreciate that you made sure to fit it in there and that
I was going to remember it.
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's what brought us together other than the Mets, right?
It is. Yes.
Lauren, I greatly appreciate you being on the show tonight. And tell everybody where they can find you. Tweet at you.
You can find all of my amazingly awesome tweets at @calmyourmets on Twitter.
And that sums it up. Keep calm and carry on. Lauren, thank you for joining us on the Mets Team Podcast tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So, Rich, your shameless plug and final word.
Well, Mesmerized Online for me, and also CT Mets Fan, Mets Fan Rich, goes by both, and on Twitter. And my last word is this. My last word is, and I think this is one word, turnaround. It's time for a turnaround. This team is too good to keep playing like this. They can turn around. I believe they will. They have some hot streaks in them. So there's no time like the present, fellas. So let's get the turnaround going.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you, Rich, as always. And thank you all out there for listening to the Metsian Podcast. And my word, or two words, my final word, is going to be keep calm. It doesn't matter. We have plenty of context. Sometimes it seems as if everybody literally just started watching the game of baseball. And maybe some people did just start watching the game of baseball, and which is not terrible. But, like, you know, maybe they only operate on a Mets level on Twitter. Maybe it's they're receiving the game via Anthony DeComo's updates for what just happened in the first inning. However you are taking the game in, you have to remember that it doesn't matter how much money you spend. It doesn't matter how on paper the talent level looks. Anything can happen. On any given day, any baseball team can beat the other team. And like they say, it's what you do with the third, you know, you have a third to win, a third to lose. It's what you do with the other third. And how you can deal with a 162-game schedule, which probably should be 154, but they're never going to want to take that revenue away. However you deal with that long of a season is in many ways a metaphor for how you deal with life. So not to make it that overdramatic, because it is still a sport, but that's one of the things that we love about sports. We can relate to it and take some of its lessons into our own lives. So keep calm, everybody, and let's go Mets. Hey, everybody. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
Thank you, New York, for being on location.
Thank you, Sam and Lauren.
Thank you.
Later, everybody. Bye now.